The question just before we broke, the residues of craving aversion still arising or being present even in the relinquishing of personality view and attachment to rules and rituals, habits and doubt. It's being aware that what we're actually talking about in this template are the way things are blown out, the way that they actually really come to cessation, not to return, okay? So it's not as if we have to wait for a stream entry realization in order to begin investigating the territory of craving and aversion. In fact, this is put really right in the very beginning of the path. You know, in the ethical guidelines, the guideline is usually delivered as, you know, refraining from sexual misconduct. The actual guideline in the early teachings is refraining from sexual and sensual misconduct. This is actually quite a critical piece that's often missed out, I'm afraid. Because sensual misconduct is the way that we misuse the sense doors in the service of craving and aversion. The way that the eyes get hungry, the ears get hungry, the mind gets hungry, the body gets hungry, the tongue gets hungry. You know, everything gets hungry for the pleasant sensation. You know, and then we see how the sense doors are misused in the service of craving when we begin, you know, go through life kind of prowling the world. A colleague of mine described it as being a beggar at the sense doors. Prowling the world for satisfaction, for that which pleases us, that which stimulates us, that which enlivens us. You know, and in the same way, the sense doors are misused. There can be misconduct at the sense doors in the service of aversion. How also our sense doors become inflamed and hypervigilant to what we don't like, what we feel threatened by, what we want to get rid of. So actually the training in craving and aversion really begins at the absolute beginning of the path, you know, not just later on. It's a practice and experiential investigation that runs through the whole of the path and the whole of the teaching. What we are talking about here in this stage of awakening, or this stage of blowing out the fires, is actually an understanding, and it's also a practice of insight. It really is an understanding of the nature of enchantment, in truth. The nature of enchantment, the way that through distorted view, the sources of happiness and unhappiness are actually posited in certain objects, in certain people, in certain events. You know, the make me happy, make me unhappy syndrome. This is the nature of enchantment. The Buddha speaks in another kind of map of awakening. The Buddha speaks about the conscious cultivation of disenchantment. You know, and this is not about making life flat. It's not about taking the wonder and the awe and the beauty and the mystery out of life. But what it is really about is really withdrawing this projected promise, you know, the promise that I've projected into this, that, or you to actually sort of make me happy because it's pleasant, you know. Or deposited in you know, the power to make me unhappy because it's unpleasant. So the Buddha speaks really about this cultivation of disenchantment leading to dispassion, leading to unbinding, leading to relinquishment. So I think this is a domain where, you know, we don't actually have to wait for stream entry to actually begin with this practice. But actually in this stage of awakening, it's actually talking about that dispassion and relinquishment born of disenchantment. You know, that actually takes us to a place of tremendous freedom. Because as long as we're in that place of enchantment, we're always looking elsewhere, aren't we? We're always looking outwardly, we're depending, we're needing, we're not wanting, we're strategizing, we're in basically imprisoned by that which we are enchanted by. So this stage of awakening is really talking about blowing out those fires of greed and hatred. Blowing out the fires of greed and hatred, that they are truly blown out through understanding, through insight. And again, there is a path here and there is a fruition. And once more, we have all the raw material at hand for both that path and for the fruition. So if we look at where we've got to so far, you know, and again, this is presented in, you know, the chains that bind us. The chains that bind us to dukkha, the chains that bind us to distress, the chains that create and recreate distress, and actually unbinding from those chains. So through the stream entry, this sakagami, anagami, there's actually really the complete freedom from what are called these five core chains. Freedom from the belief and personality view, freedom from skeptical doubt, freedom from the attachment to the habits that we lean upon for a sense of control and safety and security, a freedom from ill will, and a freedom from sensual craving. And the Buddha talks about this as being uprooted without remainder. Uprooted without remainder. This means this is actually gone. It's gone. And again, one has to sort of envisage what your life, what your mind, what your heart, what your relationships would look like in the freedom from those five chains. You know, what would that free you to be? How would that free you to respond and to live? And this is the exploration. It's not just about, it's certainly not what I'm working on, but it's what I'm investigating, what I'm exploring, what I'm beginning to sense inwardly. Because craving and ill will, you know, greed and hatred, they're not just the capital big words. They're very subtle waves in the mind. And when they are present, freedom is not. And the Buddha was very clear that when we're actually engaged in the pursuit of greed and hatred, we have abandoned freedom. It's just, you know, that's a big step. That when we're engaged with greed and hatred, we have abandoned metta. We have abandoned generosity. So the kind of encouragement was to almost reclaim what has been abandoned, to reclaim generosity, to reclaim metta, to reclaim sufficiency, an inner sense of sufficiency. And this too is the blowing out of greed and hatred. Now, these are almost refinements. You have to think of this map, this template, as almost a process, not only of kind of relinquishing, but it's actually a process of refinement. And the arahant, you know, the fully awakened person, is a further refinement. And it's really the cessation of all ignorance. Now, if you remember yesterday at some point, I was talking about leaking and nibbana ceasing to leak, you know, ceasing to leak the tendencies. Some of these tendencies are very, very subtle. One of those tendencies is actually the habit of ignorance or the pattern of ignorance or the distortions that we talked about yesterday. The arahant releases the craving for fine material existence and the craving for immaterial existence. This releasing the craving for becoming in any form. For becoming this, becoming that, even becoming, you know, the Arahant. It's releasing craving in all forms. It's releasing restlessness, but most importantly, it is releasing mana, this conceit of self. Because this is actually, you know, certainly in Buddhist psychology, this is the most, probably the most subtle, the most pervasive, the most pernicious kind of place of establishing centralization. You know, it's not like personality view, which is, you know, shaped and reshaped and formed and reformed. Mana, as we talked about it yesterday, is much this much subtler sense of who we are, you know, and where we are in relationship to all things. It's actually far. It's a view rather than necessarily something that is formed and reformed. It's much more like an underlying view. And the Arahant is a fully awakened one. It's the one who is really free from mana, amana. No conceit of self. No conceit of self. And this is where the Buddha describes a freedom that cannot be measured, the sublime peace, the boundless liberation. And as the Buddha put it, you know, birth is destroyed. Now, what is meant by that? It means the end of becoming, the end of the forming, of the end of the fabricating of, you know, an I am and this is. That birth is destroyed, and so too is death is destroyed, which is why sometimes the understanding of the Arahant is really referred to as the deathless, because it's also the birthless. It's no longer fabricating worlds of existence that come into being and then pass out of being. No longer fabricating selves that come into being and that pass out of being. This, the Buddha puts it, but is actually the boundless and unshakable liberation of heart. I think as a pathway, you know, we actually, it's fine to approach this in a developmental way. And it's fine to approach this in a developmental way, but it's even finer to approach this in an intentional way, as an intentional domain of investigation. But what's also so important to remember that the context again, you know, this exploration is not in the service of some, you know, refined state of mind or personal happiness or any of those things. This is really in the service of understanding dukkha and bringing dukkha to an end. Bringing dukkha to an end. And it is actually so, so crucial that we have confidence in the possibility that this indeed can be so. That this indeed can be so. That distress and struggle is not a life sentence, it's not a, you know, it's not a condition we have to learn to endure or bear. Certainly we are asked to learn to embrace life's actualities, which includes all the losses, all the joys, all the sorrows, which are really part of being a relational human being. You know, this we will not move away from. But there is a possibility of a tremendous, profound freedom of heart in the midst of it all, in the midst of it all. So the Buddha did not speak about, when he speaks about ending dukkha, he did not speak about ending, you know, somehow finding a magic broom to somehow whisk away aging, sickness, death, you know, or somehow finding a new kind of sublime permanence, you know. Didn't speak about this is not the dukkha that is ended. What is the dukkha that is ended is the dukkha of selfing and fabrication and construction and reactivity and these patterns that keep us really locked in that cycle of creating and recreating distress. And that this truly is what can come to an end. And I think as practitioners, you know, as I mentioned yesterday, it is truly important that we consider ourselves students of Nibbana. But to recognize that this calls a lot of us, you know, this asks a lot from us. It asks a great deal of, you know, dedication and perseverance and ardency and passion and enthusiasm and commitment. This is not a hobby. This is actually not a hobby. This is actually something that calls on actually us to recognize the potential of our capacities as human beings. And this is what the Buddha was really speaking to, you know, our capacities for freedom, our capacities for awakening, you know, in this life, you know, in this life, in this body that we have right now, you know, in this mind that we have right now, in this situation that we're in right now. This is where the Buddha actually placed this awakening process. So again, yeah, I actually don't have anything more to say. For at least this particular weekend, I have done what needs to be done. or I have done what can be done. You know? That is actually it. That's actually the stages of awakening. I hope that to some extent, have managed to demystify Nibbana, but more of all, I hope that somehow I've conveyed the confidence that, you know, you can have in partaking of that process of awakening. That's it. Does anybody have any remaining questions, please, before we pack up? Yes, please.
You mentioned that stream entry was beyond good and evil, beyond the past lives, and beyond the realm of the I am.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Well, then we have to touch upon this word karma. Okay? And karma in Buddhist teaching means action, okay? And it means volitional formations. So volitional formations are karma. Volitional formations are like the gas in the car, you know? It keeps the car moving in certain tracks and in certain ways. So volitional formations, actually, the ones that are spoken of in terms of the context of dukkha, are those that bind us to distress, you know, and the identification with them. So it is beyond both good and evil, you know, because it's no longer identifying even with the good volitional formations, never mind the bad ones, because the sankharas that are rooted in ignorance no longer have any fuel. No longer have any fuel. Yeah. So actually the Buddha speaks about the end of karma, you know? The end of those volitional impulses that are rooted in confusion and distortion.
Are you saying that they still come up?
No. No, this is what I'm saying. This is where we keep fudging it, you know. in this map of awakening, they are gone. They are gone. You know, the Buddha's not talking about things just coming up and not being identified with. He actually says they're gone, you know. And I think that's really important to wrap our minds around, you know. This is not about sort of having a more non-identified relationship with the difficult and the unwholesome, the unskillful and ignorant. It means it's gone, you know, and I just want to put that out there again, because, you know, we keep thinking, oh, well, you know, it's just that I've resolved identification or I've resolved clinging. I see Buddhists are not arising. They have ceased without remainder. This is the really big picture to envisage, you know, that these are not arising. That with the taking away of the ignorance, there is no ground for the arising of distress-making patterns. There is no ground for it, so there is no arising. Now, that is developmental, obviously. You know, I mean, we see that in practice, don't we? We actually start to recognize things better. We start to respond more skillfully. We start to feel less identified. The kind of process of clinging and grasping starts to lessen and soften. That is a developmental and a wonderful, wonderful freeing development in practice. But then we need to take that also to its fruition, which actually that is the path, and the fruition is that the ground for the arising is no longer there. It's actually gone. Then that's the life to actually reflect on what that life would look like. Yes, there's still change. Yes, there's still losses. Yes, there's still joys, you know. I mean, if you look at the life of the Buddha, he had all of that in his whole life, you know. It was fully awake, but he was moving in a world, you know, where there was lots of greed and hatred, moving in a world where he had his own losses and his own griefs and his own joys. But there was never that movement into somehow being entangled. It was gone. He was not a dysfunctional human being. You know, the people I've known in my life, the most awakened people, are very functional people. You know? They're responsive people. They're compassionate people. But the ground for distortion is gone. That's a big one to actually get our heads around. Ceased without remainder is how the Buddha puts it. Ceased without remainder.
Could you refer us to any either things that you've written or on other books where this is laid out?
There's part of it is laid out in this book, although some of it is commentarial. And I think you always need to bear that in mind when you read, that some of this is commentarial. But in the back of this book, in the Buddha's Words, it's probably one of the few places, but The Island is a good book. The Island by Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Pasano, I think it is. Pasano, is it? The Island, the book called The Island by Ajahn Amaro. Is a wonderful book on Nibbana. And that really does draw on really the early texts rather than mostly on commentarial traditions. All right, yes. Well, the Buddha says that this Dharma, like the ocean, has only one taste, which is salt. He says this Dharma has only one taste, which is freedom. So actually this theme of freedom, of course, runs through all of the teachings because it's all about liberating the mind from the entanglements that actually create dukkha. And that's the taste of freedom. Okay, thank you for your sturdy attentiveness. Very sturdy attentiveness. Very good, sturdy attentiveness.